Robbie H. from Phoenix, Arizona. The 2016 fall retreat in Birmingham, Alabama, titled How Getting Sober Led to My Primary Purpose.
Stop acting out. I am so happy that my buddy Robbie is coming to speak to us today at the retreat. I met him at the ISO-SAA convention in Las Vegas. And just to make a long story short, if you want to hear the longer story, he and I would be glad to tell you our different versions of the story. But just the way that he handled himself in the meeting, he actually stood up for the meeting boundaries. And when somebody was violating the meeting boundaries, he stood up for the meeting boundaries. And I think it might have been the first time that I'd ever heard somebody do that. And I was like, wow, I've got to meet this guy. And so we got to know each other better. Since then, we've spoken at a few events together. And I've gotten to spend a lot of time around him. And during the time that I've spent around him, I've really seen that he's the real deal. He really walks what he talks. He spends a lot of time on the phone with sponsees. He really takes his role as a person in recovery, as a person working step 12, carrying the message to other addicts who suffer. He takes that really, really seriously in his life. I've never seen somebody so passionate about the SAA literature. And I've been on the literature committee for like 4 years, and he's more passionate about the SAA literature than I am. So I was just really, really just surprised to see somebody with such life about the SAA message of recovery and such a dedication not only to carry to other people who are suffering, but to work that second part of step 12 to practice those principles in all aspects of his life. So I am super pumped to have him here speaking to us today. And another part of him that I'm really excited about is the fact that he wants to hang out and talk and have conversations, have recovery conversations in between the times when he's up here speaking with the microphone. So get a hold of him, grab him, talk to him, challenge him on stuff. He loves to be challenged. That's another thing. He's going to say some things that you are going to disagree with. When he says those things, remember them. Go talk to him about it. Ask him, what's up with this? I think this is ridiculous. And he will love to have a conversation with you about that. So, Robbie, thank you so much for being here today. Let's say the Serenity Prayer together. We'll just say the me-I version of the Serenity Prayer. And then Robbie will come up and speak to us.
Second, to get this computer on, I'm really electronically challenged. So I brought a backup paper. Awesome. God is good. It worked. My expectations have been exceeded. All right. Hi, I'm Robbie. I'm a recovered sex addict. Okay, kids. Game on. Let's play, right? I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a little scared. I can hear the voices, as I said earlier, outside my head. I'm used to the voices inside my head, so this is a little unnerving. So bear with me. So preparing to speak today, someone said I should start with a topical joke. I only know dirty jokes and political jokes, and those aren't happening today, so off the rack. So then I got some advice that I should talk about the Alabama Holy Trinity. Someone said it's Dale Earnhardt, Elvis Presley, and Bear Bryant. Well, I don't know a lot about those people. I'm not from Alabama. They're the Holy Trinity, and I'm Jewish. So I can't relate to any of that stuff at all. So no relation. So, you know. But I think I can relate to you about the solution, about the 12-step solution to our sex addiction. And that's really what I want to talk to you about today. I think what really unites us together isn't our problem. It's not our acting out, not our character defects, but our common solution, the 12 steps. And so I hope to share with you today how that solution has affected my life, okay? Well, I qualify as a sex addict, just in case you wondered, right? I always got to qualify. Am I a sex addict? It's been a little bit since I've acted out. Today, my inner circle is casual sex, anonymous sex, porn, adult businesses, flirting outside of a dating context, sexualized conversations, seeking images and materials with sexual intent, and masturbation. A very different inner circle than when I first came in. When I first came in, my inner circle was lying about the people I was boinking outside of my relationship. If I could just be honest about who I was sleeping around with, I was sober, you know? Yeah, well, that's the best I could do when I first came in, you know? But through the years, my inner circle has evolved. I claim my sobriety date is May 1st, 2009. And as I go through my story, you'll see how that has evolved. Apparently, some of the other folks in my life, a lot of the other folks in my life, the neighbors, the people at the gas station, the hotels, the bars, my family, people on the highway, people who could see, were aware I was a sex addict. I didn't have an idea. I had no clue whatsoever. I thought I was just living my destiny. I thought I was just popular and driven, you know? I was neither. But there was some evidence I was a sex addict that I missed. So some of the evidence, you know, you might be a sex addict if, you know, apparently you might be a sex addict if you're featured in a porn in the late 80s. Yes, I have screen credits, but there was no Academy Award for my performance. It wasn't that stellar, apparently, you know? Yes, you might be a sex addict if you have gonorrhea so much you get, like, the punch card at the free clinic, you know? Two more and I would have gotten a free meal, but you know, luckily enough, I didn't get the free meal. Unfortunately, you might be a sex addict if you got arrested, like I did. If I lost my teaching credential, lost my livelihood, lost my identity, lost everything I'd worked for, but I pushed through and kept going with my sex addiction, yeah? Might be a sex addict if you struggle with monogamy. I'm 49. I look good, but I'm 49. You know, and from the ages of 19 to 40, I was always in a relationship. Sometimes one, sometimes two, but I was always in a relationship, you know? I was even married at some point for like 9 years. Stranger things could happen, right? But and I never left one relationship before the next one started. There was always a little period of overlap, just in case. Don't want to hedge my bets, right? Kind of like with a job. You don't quit one before you get a new one. Same thing with relationships. Even though I was always in a relationship from age 19 to 41, somehow I managed to have sex with over 2,637 other sex partners. And you might be a sex addict if you counted, right? You know, who else doesn't count? I don't know, you know? You'd figure once you're into like the four figures, you lose count. But nah, not me. You didn't count. It must be an Alabama thing, I guess. I don't know. Might be a sex addict if your sex addiction ever caused you to have sex with someone you weren't attracted to. You know, and sometimes people I wasn't proud of or, you know, used or whatever. You see, maybe like you, my sex addiction took me to some really crazy places, places I would never imagine. I even had sex with women, you know? I'm not proud of it, not ashamed of it. It's just not who I am, you know? You know, it's kind of apparent I'm gayer than a $3 bill, and yet I was having sex with women. But, you know, any port in a storm when you're a sex addict, and I was like the frickin' Sharknado of sex addiction, so blown it down. I can't really say I was a prostitute. I just traded my attention for life's luxuries, you know? And I thought I lived a luxurious life. Pulled a Geographic. You know, who wants to live in a beach house in Santa Barbara overlooking the ocean, right? Nah. I'd rather move to Tucson to live behind a gas station, you know, because that was the issue, my location. And if I could just get out of California, quit making so much money, quit having a retirement account and a lovely home, no, I'd rather, you know, be underemployed, undervalued, and underappreciated. That's what I did. You know, there are many, many more examples, apparently, that I was a sex addict. And today I'm not trying to, out-tramp you or out-whore you or outdo you or anything like that. It's just that from time to time, I need to be reminded of the total insanity of my addiction and the different ways my disease tried to kill me. I need to be reminded. And, you know, sometimes when you're sober a little bit, I forget how much it hurt, you know? Sometimes the vision back, it wasn't that bad. No, going through that list I just went through, it was that bad. And those were kind of the easier parts. So let's talk about growing up, right? Oh, I don't know growing up if anyone ever told me if I was good enough. I don't know if they did that, if I was man enough, if I was smart enough, if I was rich enough, if I was enough. I don't know that I got that message. The message I recall, and I don't know if it was given to me or if I gave it to myself, was that I didn't matter. You know, that was invisible. Just didn't show up. I needed to be silent, you know. I didn't exist. You know, my feeling of myself growing up was if they took roll and I wasn't there, they wouldn't be able to check, you know, not there, because they wouldn't have noticed. Just felt that to my core. And as an adult, no one else had to tell me these things. No one had to convince me of that, because I did it all for myself. And I told myself that with every breath, with every conversation, with every look in the mirror, with every moment, I told myself that you don't matter. It's okay. Disappear. You just don't measure up. You're not man enough. And so, and that not man enough thing played a big role in my life. Not man enough. And the only thing that changed those feelings was what you could tell me by having sex with you, having sex with your wife, your husband, my boss, my employees, myself. The only thing that convinced me that I was man enough, smart enough, good enough, worthy enough, everything enough, was to act out. And it worked really well. It worked when I was on the hunt. It worked when I was on the prowl. It worked when I was looking. It worked afterwards. It worked really well. It worked so well that that's all I did until it stopped working. You know, it's like a great medication. It works great until you take too much of it. Then it begins to kill you. And it really began to kill me. I came into SAA Saturday, August 3rd, 2007. I don't know how I get to remember date, that one date. I don't remember a lot of other things, but I remember that date. It wasn't the worst day. You know, it wasn't the end all. I'd already been arrested years before. I'd already bankrupted myself several times. Diseases, everything. It wasn't the worst day. It wasn't the best day. It was just the final day. Maybe I wasn't like some of you. I wasn't getting done. I was getting caught. Anyone getting caught when you came in, you get dragged in by the ear. Yeah, I was dragged in by the ear, all right. It was just the day that my partner couldn't take anymore, and I couldn't take anymore. You know, I was in yet another alcohol-filled, drug-filled, sex-obsessed, chaotic, destructive, you know, kind of whirling dervish of a relationship that whatever it hit did not turn to gold. I did not have the Midas touch at that point in time. I had a lot of touch, and there wasn't a lot of Midas, you know? Unbeknownst to me, my boyfriend, he was talking about my acting out with other people. Can you believe that? That jerk. And even more shocking and offensive, he was talking about it with another ex. Son of a biscuit, right? These two dudes that I acted out on, that I screwed over, that I stole from, that I, you know, adulterated, whatever. They were keeping scorecards. And they got together. And they decoded the mystery. Dude, this wasn't just a one-time thing. This wasn't just a situational thing. He's been doing this for years after year after year. So they put together the math and figured, I might be a sex addict. Huh. And, you know, they figured that, you know, all my trouble, all my issues, all the pain I was causing might be because of the way I treated sex, the way sex treated me. And I might want to look at that. And for some reason that day, I didn't have enough fight in me to say no. And thank God I didn't have enough fight in me. I don't really know about this hitting bottom thing. A lot of us talk about hitting bottom, you know, how bad it got. I think I'd hit bottom a long time before then. You'd think getting arrested was enough. You'd think giving up my life was enough. My career, all that was enough, but it wasn't. And I think it goes back to that not being enough, because I'd hit bottom. I just never bounced off of it. I hit there, like, not a thump, but like a splat, you know, and just kind of stayed there. I thought that's the way life was going to be. I was lucky to get the scraps of life. You know, some of us at our table today at breakfast felt like we were at the kids' table. You know, the chair was too short and the table was up here. You know, and that's kind of how I felt life was like for me. You all were at the adult table, you know, with the chairs and in the china. And I didn't even get chinette in my life. You know, I was in the paper plates, the kind of flimsy fold. And yeah, I thought I was living on the bottom. That was the best I was going to get to eke out. I didn't know that there was another way to live. So I didn't get to bounce off the bottom initially. I just got to live there. for quite a while. And like I said, why wouldn't I? Because sex, acting out, all the things that I did, it worked. It acting out for me was like mainlining. You know, I'm also an alcoholic and a drug addict. And my alcoholism, it worked, but I kind of overshot the mark a lot on that. You know, I couldn't time my alcohol right. I was either not drunk enough or throwing up in your lap. You know, I couldn't quite get the dosage right, you know, all the drugs I was taking, you know, I'd vomit, I'd be too high, I'd be, you know, getting the Narcan kind of stuff. But the sex addiction, it was like mainlining. It worked right to the core. It corrected all my doubts. You know, it resolved all my insecurities. It cleared up my acne, you know, it grew my hair back, you know, it was a miracle drug, man. It just worked on everything, you know. But unfortunately, it really sucked. I like that term, it really sucked to be a gay man who hated himself for being gay. So the only way to deal with that was to have sex with other men who could somehow magically convince me that I really am man enough, you know, by allowing me to degrade myself with them, because of them, for them. And it worked. What a crappy way to live. What a crappy way to live. And maybe like all of you, I've done looking back. You know, I've worked with professionals outside of the fellowship and some phenomenal sponsors. And I've looked back at and asked those questions, the why. You know, where did this start? Who planted this seed in me, you know? You know, and I'm not sure if I'm a sex addict because my mommy potty trained me wrong. I might be, you know? Did your mom use those Cheerios in the toilet to teach you how to aim? Anyone? No? No? That question is for the boys. If some of the girls got that, rock on for you ladies, you know? But I don't know if I'm a sex addict because my mommy potty trained me wrong or my dad's a rager. I don't know if that combination makes a sex addict, you know? I have an older brother and a sister. And so I would assume if that combination made sex addicts, then my brother and my sister would be sex addicts too, right? I'm like, well, you know, they both dealt with, I guess, with their upbringing, you know, in different ways. I'm a Catholic Jew, and she converted to Mormonism, and he's a White Sox fan, you know? We all dealt with our upbringing our own ways. The sad thing is, I got sober. He's still a White Sox fan, you know? Maybe there's a program for Ricky someday, you know? So let's go back to that first meeting I went to. First meeting I went to was in Tucson, Arizona. I didn't enter only a broken man, a really, really broken man. But my first meeting, you know, I dragged myself in a really drunk man. My ass was drunk. I left work middle of the day, told my boss, look, here's the deal. And she supported me. So we went out for shots at the sushi bar to get me ready for my first meeting. You know, support, you know? We can always find people to support us, can't we, you know? You're going to need to get drunk to go to this meeting. And it's like, oh, thank you. So, somehow we got the bartender to make a to-go cup of liquor to go to a 12-step meeting. I think there's always someone willing to help. So I entered a very, very drunk man. And they welcomed me anyway. Later on, I found out that they really knew I was drunk. I thought I'd, you know, pass it off. No, they knew. They're hugging me like this, head turned, you know. That fellowship was really great about outside issues. How drunk I was, how messy I was, how chaotic I was, wasn't the issue. The issue was that I thought I might have a problem. And they said, come to us anyway. No, like all these open chairs in the front row, they always left chairs for me every meeting I went to, no matter how drunk I was, you know. Back then, no one smoked in the fellowship, and I was 2 packs a day of cloves. So I'd come in smelling cloves. They smell like roses and butt, you know, but I was smelling them, smoking them. So I'd come in drunk, smoking, you know, and then I'd leave halfway through the prayer to go outside to take another drink and smoke, and they would keep welcoming me back. They really believed in that, you know, let us love you until you can love yourself. They did love me until I could love myself. They really kind of boosted me up, held me up while I was falling apart. I was jello, and they just made it okay to keep coming back. You know, they live that third tradition. The only requirement is a desire to stop addictive sexual behavior. I don't know if I had that desire when I came in. I don't know if I even qualified as, you know, because I didn't have that desire. I wanted to stop hurting. I wanted to stop getting in trouble. I somehow wanted things to work out a little bit better. I don't know if I wanted to stop acting out, as evidenced by, you know, my continuing to act out for a while. But they still let me come in. Maybe I just had a little foot of desire, you know, a little toe of desire, and that was enough, you know? I have really strong, loving, fond memories of that fellowship. It's really exciting every year when I go to convention. I get to see the couple that greeted me at my first meeting. I don't remember anything else but their faces, you know? But I remember them fondly. And that group, and they created a space. They let me sit in the back and hold up the wall. Apparently, the wall was fine for them, but I could hold up the wall, you know? They let me come in the room and check everyone's shoelaces for month after month to make sure they were tied, you know? They let me listen, meaning they didn't ask me to speak. You know, they did this thing where they hugged me. Son of a bitch, they hugged me a lot, you know? And this is in Tucson. It, you know, at the end of the meeting when we pray, you know, we all hold hands. They're a really loving community, so they would hug. Now, this is Tucson in the desert. They're all wearing tank tops, and it's really hot and sweaty, and they're hugging. That's how they love. I wasn't up for that stuff, hippies, you know, but they loved me. They kept loving me, and I'm really grateful for that. Carry that with me today. And a little side note about the fellowship down there. It's about 50% women. It's a very mixed fellowship. And so I think there's an element of that loving. There's that nurturing part because it was a blended fellowship, and I've carried kind of that value with me to my recovery today. And even though I love that fellowship and I really know that they owned them, the third tradition, my memory tells me that they forgot the fifth tradition. You know, the SA has but one primary purpose, to carry the SA message that freedom from addictive sexual behavior is possible through the 12 steps. My memory tells me they did a lot of love, a lot of nurturing, but they didn't have a strong message in that area. And I have feelings about sharing that. You know, that's my memory, that they made me feel welcome. But some of the messages I got in the room, some of the language I heard was, relapse is part of recovery. It wasn't a question of, you know, if I would relapse, but when. Or things like, act out less often. Less often, you know, that's my shooting for the, don't shoot high, you know, don't shoot for the, you know, freedom, but less often. And so that I really grabbed onto that message, you know, or not as severe. You hear that message? I acted out, but not on my deepest, darkest inner circle, not the really dirty stuff, you know. I'm not hooking up with people at the bathhouse or, you know, I live by campus, so I'm not sitting on my front porch, calling the college guys over to smoke the opium in my front yard so so I could be neighborly. No, I'm not doing that. I was doing something less severe. I was just watching a little porn for 6 hours a night on my front porch. Yeah. But it wasn't as severe, you know. It was just a little bit of porn, you know. As a sex addict, I can't measure amounts, you know, or time, I guess. And they also did this thing in the fellowship where they gave out chips for time in recovery. They also gave out chips for how long you've been sober, for time in. I remember this one meeting, a gentleman, he took his 20-year chip. Amazing 20-year chip. And in the same meeting, he took a 2-month chip. And it just confused the hell out of me. You know, thinking back to that primary purpose, SA has only one message, just one. So, you know, the steps, the book identifies one primary purpose. It never identifies a secondary purpose. And a chip for time in, congratulations. Attendance. You know, it was like the T-ball trophy. Yay. And I have sadness about this because they loved me so much. They made it so safe to be in the room. Yet the message, and I don't know if the fellowship there offered anything more than, you know, that third tradition message. And also, I don't know if I could have accepted anything more than that message. You know, I don't know if I could do anything more than just be safe being in the room, you know, getting that once a week, 1 hour of respite. I don't know if I was capable of anything more and just, you know, getting my head a little bit above water, taking a gasp of air and going back down into the water of my addiction, you know? I don't know if I could do any more at that time. And I don't know if I was given the choice. You know, I don't know if I was offered anything more. Now, in 5 years, my recollection may clear up. Remember, you know, alcoholic drug addict, so this may not be fully accurate. We'll find out. Yeah, for the first year or so in the program, I worked that program of relief. You know, I just wanted to hurt less. I didn't think I deserved to be free from the pain, so I just wanted to take the edge off, just knock it down to a manageable level of pain. You know, I was okay being wounded but not dead. You know, a gaping open wound is okay. I can cover it with you know, velvet pants or something. I don't know. You know, I worked a very isolated program that first year. Very much a victim of that 1,000-pound phone. Did not give my phone number to those people. You know, it's funny, didn't give my phone number to those people, but I went to one meeting one day and someone wound up being a roommate for like 6 months of mine. Never talked to the guy before, never gotten his phone number, and all of a sudden he's in my spare bedroom. I don't know. But even with him living with me, I worked a very isolated program. I didn't connect, didn't share, didn't contribute, didn't invest. You know, I think I was kind of like a dry drunk or a dry hump in the room, you know? The periods of abstinence that I had were just because I wasn't doing something. You know, I'd come home from work. I'd come home from work, I'd padlock the picket fence so I'd have trouble getting out, you know? Change into pajamas, eat a whole pizza, then I'd be too full to act out, you know? Don't want, like, sloshy belly sex, I don't know. And that was my way of not acting out, and it was the best I could do at the time. Because it was very much at that time a not acting out program, not a program of sobriety and surrender. It was very much a self-will program. I showed up, you know, I even got a sponsor. Someone who was sitting next to me and was willing, you know, and I worked with that sponsor. You know, I'd see her once a week. So I would do step work once a week, you know, see her at 11 on Saturday. So 10:15, I'm getting out the notebook, you know, crumpling the paper so it looked like I used it all week. You know, I'm getting like 3 different color pens, you know, a red pen, a blue pen, and a pencil, changing the writing really fast, the handwriting, you know, the little coffee rings to make it look like I'd been at all week long. And it was awesome. And really that 45 minutes was quality step work. I got to the root of the issue in that 45 minutes, you know, it was like a weekly shower as a kid at summer camp, you know, I was dirty and smelly. I was doing a lot of box checking. I was attending SAA. And the sponsor, God love her, and at the time I was really pissed, but God love her, she actually told me, look, you're going to have trouble working the third step if you're always drunk. That bitch, right? Outside issue, you know? I didn't tell her that the last week I'd been to see her to do step work, I'd vomited my Chinese chicken salad all over my dashboard because I was hungover, but somehow she knew that it was an issue. I think she's clairvoyant, you know? So it's kind of funny. So she said I needed to go get sober. I needed to go to the other program. And I'm really grateful for that. You know, SAA took me from what I was and built me up to the point where I could participate in the program. You know, they loved me until I could love myself enough to consider I should maybe work the steps. You know, I'd been doing that box checking step work in SAA, and luckily enough, Wanda sent me over to AA to get sober. And for me, that equation was very necessary. Your equation might have been different. She sent me over to AA to not work just a tools of recovery program, you know, not just work a not act out program. She sent me over to the other program to learn how to work the fundamentals of the program. You know, that other program gave me hope. It gave me a foundation, a very rigorous, concrete foundation of what the program, what sobriety looks like. The other program taught me the spiritual principles that I could take into the other areas of my life. It's like SAA built me from nothing to someone who might receive the steps, sent me over here to AA to kind of work the steps, and now I wanted sobriety. And then I got shuffled back, you know? I worked both programs for about a year. dual program sponsors in both program, and things began to change, things really began to change. And what happened is I began to have an awakening because of my work in AA. I began to have an awakening that I didn't just want to not act out, that I was getting this, not just relief in AA, but this reliance on a higher power around my alcoholism and around the issues that were behind that. Yet I wasn't fully transferring that over here to SAA. I was still abstinent in SAA, not yet sober. And I began to have this awakening, like, oh my God, this thing I'm getting in AA, I could actually get that in SAA, but I can't work the program in SAA the way I have been. I can't be around the rooms. I can't be full of shame. I can't be isolated. I can't be quiet. I can't work this half-assed, do as little as I can, minimum requirement program, and expect to be fully transformed the way I was feeling in AA. It was a real conflict. If I was to get that spiritual relief, that spiritual awakening, that reliance on a higher power, that if I was to get all those promises that AA was talking about, I was going to have to work the same way in both programs. So things had to change. Now, during that time period, I changed sponsors in SAA. I found a sponsor who had what I wanted. He was dating. Because I'd been, I've been sober, I don't know, hour and a half, a month, 6 months, whatever, He had what he wanted. He was dating, so I was going to follow him. And I was grateful because he's the one that told me I could have porn in my middle circle. Cha-ching, Yeah, no. At least for me. So to have this awakening, some changes had to happen in SAA. I changed sponsors. I changed from a sponsor who had what I wanted to had what I needed. I had no idea what I needed, but I knew I needed someone else. Changed my circles. Changed my circles to sobriety. I'd been claiming sobriety for about a year then because all I was doing was front porch porn, and it was in my middle circle. So changed my sobriety date, changed my circles. I changed how I worked the steps, to that primary first order. Nothing else could come before my steps, before my program. I changed how I participated in the fellowship from attending, to participating, to contributing, later on we had, the steps of the spiritual solution. I'd been such a tourist. I became a resident, a property owner, I really dug in, and I changed my sobriety date. I changed my sobriety date to May 1st, 2009. And even though I'd been technically sober, I wanted more than a technical program, And my sobriety date, May 1st, 2009, isn't the last day I acted out. It was sometime before then. But it was the first day that I didn't act out because of my reliance on a higher power. And I think, that's what a sobriety date is. I had an abstinent date before then, a date I had stopped acting out. But that's the first day I can remember that my sex addiction, the obsession, had been removed because I was seeking a reliance on a higher power. So that's my sobriety date. And to have that sobriety date, that surrender, I was reading through my green book, and it's a workbook, right? You're writing there all over the place, and I think I need it. There's a note in there somewhere that talks about my surrender, not my sobriety. My disease required not just a surrender, but a profound surrender. Not just an I give up, but, I give up, that slap on the table, profound surrender. It says that somewhere in the green book. It requires a profound surrender. I tried just a surrender. I give up. Yeah, I'm done. But no, that profound surrender was every cell in my body had to surrender. I'd been sick and tired of being sick and tired out of the rooms. And luckily enough, I got to the point where I was sick and tired of being sick and tired in the rooms. That abstinence, that half recovery, that self-reliance, that minimal program did not work. It wasn't getting me the life that I was born to have. I had a sponsor that told me, I was special. I knew I was special. I'm a special snowflake, if you didn't know that, I'm special. And he said that my disease was so special, it wouldn't require just acceptance, but radical acceptance. He was like, game on, boy. This is not the regular kind of attendance. Get on with it, you know? Not just a belief in a higher power, but I was to seek a spiritual awakening like it was my lifeblood. And I got this motivation, this expectation, and it really changed my program. It changed what I went to the meetings for, you know? I went to the meetings to invest, to give, and to receive, you know, taking away from each person. And it really it made a big difference, you know? And as a result, I began to receive that blueprint that we're after. You know, through all my acting out, I thought I was the only person in the world that didn't get the owner's manual. You all have heard that, right? You all got the instruction booklet. And I was stuck with the IKEA, you know, directions in life. And I didn't get that damn little tool to put life together, you know? I couldn't picture them. They were in some other language. Didn't understand it. My life was wobbly like that bookshelf you have in your spare bedroom, right? That was my life. I didn't get the instruction manual. But through working this program, I started understanding that blueprint for full and successful living. You know, the steps didn't get me sober. They were just teaching me a way to live life without acting out and beyond. And, you know, that blueprint, it really did begin with working the steps, the 12 steps of SAA. I already mentioned my relationship with both programs. You know, AA taught me how to work the 12 steps of AA, and they gave me a great foundation. But I also needed to work the 12 steps of SAA. And for me, and your experience can be different, it's your experience, for me, there was a difference. I mentioned before the meeting, I don't know if I'm a drunken slut or a slutty drunk. You know, I don't know which came first. What I do know is, when I feel this, sometimes I feel that alcohol and drugs was what I did, but sex addiction was who I was at the cellular level. And I really needed the 12 steps of SAA that really helped me not understand the principles of the 12 steps, spiritual awakening, but there was something about my disease, my addiction that was a little different than my disease and addiction was in AA. Even though that foundation is the basis of this recovery. And that relationship, I can't have my SAA recovery without the 12 steps of AA. Yet when I was in AA, it wasn't enough to deal with the shame, the embarrassment, those feelings I had about who I was, you know? So that blueprint, it's been based on the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the spiritual principles, you know, a God-centered life. You know, earlier I mentioned I'm a Catholic Jew. And that spiritual pursuit. So I'm a Catholic Jew, mixing up holidays in the family, I don't kind of know where I am. I feel that, like, that blood Jew in me, you know what I mean? That calling, that connection to the family, who somehow in his drunken disease, someone pointed out this out to me a few years ago, I have a tattoo on my leg of a cross. I'm a Catholic Jew and I have a cross, so they're a little conflicted, you know, and in my adult years, you know, Catholic Jew, I went to a Presbyterian college, you know, good shame place, you know, 500 people, you know, 499 Mennonites and me, you know, we learned a lot. Then I taught at a Nazarene school, you know, and all this time seeking God, and I found God after being arrested, you know, in a public bathroom. You know, and today I get to carry the message to, you know, a group. I live in Mesa, Arizona. I get to carry the message as a Catholic Jew, Presbyterian College, Nazarene School. I get to carry the message to a bunch of sexually addicted Mormons. God has a plan. I'm not sure what it is, you know. I'm a little bit of a church mutt I'm feeling right now. I keep finding out that, God is constant. You know, there's one solution. We all have a different experience in that solution. We may all attach different language to it, describing it from our own background, our own vocabulary, but we're talking about the same thing. And it's really cool, talking about the same solution. And life got good in Tucson. I got sober. I got a car back. When I first came into the program, I got rid of my car. I couldn't trust myself to drive. So I'm riding around the public bus. My, you know, Prada leather pants, my Versace jacket, looking all styling on the back of the bus because I couldn't handle driving, you know, the mixture of my life. Life got good. I got a job. My house was looking good. I finally pulled up all the opium poppies in the front yard. That wasn't, you know, I had the big burning ritual in the front yard of all my acting out stuff. Little hint, do not light velvet hot pants on fire. They burn for hours, okay? Hours. It was like the poltergeist coming out of my crotch, you know? Bad, bad juju. You know, I was beginning to sponsor. I had sobriety now, not the absence I had before. Life was good. Well, usually what happens when life is good? Yeah, but God came to me. And God said, well, you got sober now. Do you want to remain sober? Do you want to grow your sobriety? Yeah, I guess, you know, yeah. So God told me to move to Phoenix. And I say that not lightly. God told me to move to Phoenix. You know, being on that spiritual journey, God told me, you, I've got this position for you. You're hired. You don't need a resume. I already know your qualifications. You will be moving. Oh, moving to Phoenix. What the heck am I going to do in Phoenix? It's hot there. You know that? So, and God wasn't just asking me to move in Phoenix. He wanted me to not just believe in him, but he wanted me to believe him. That's a big transition in my recovery. So not just believe in him, but believe what he said. Believe the promises. You know, the ninth step promises, the spiritual awakening. Believe that it would all happen, that it was true. Now, I was working the program. I was getting sober. But some of that stuff, I still believed it was good for you. You know, I had gotten enough. I wasn't acting out. I was employable again. I was mostly honest, you know. I was paying many of my bills, you know. I believed I'd gotten all I could out of this stuff. It wasn't like it was before. I was content with what I had. And God told me there was more. So he asked me move to Phoenix to trust him, to seek him, to serve him, to fulfill my primary purpose. And that primary purpose is to carry the SA message to the addict who still suffers. And outside, but especially inside the rooms. So kind of cool. Calls me to Phoenix, right? And he wanted me to get a new sponsor. I'm feeling to work a new program, a deeper program, to practice these principles, to be impactful in my life and the life of others in SAA. And I don't take those words lightly. They're big words for me. It feels really weird to be used and be useful, you know, to God and to you all. And so he moves me. Guess where he moves me? The same damn fellowship where there's no steps, no solution, no promise. Let us, you know, circle around and talk about relief, right? Yeah, that's where he sent me. And I've been in Phoenix now about 6 years. And my life and my recovery has grown in ways I could not have imagined. Thank God he moved me. I was so contented with the life that I had. Everything was good enough. Apparently, when I seek a relationship with a higher power, he provides me a life that's better than good enough, better than my wildest dreams. So I've got a home group, and I think I was talking to someone else last night. I'm really proud of my home group. You know, I brag about my home group. It's a phenomenal place. And later on tonight, I get to talk to you about my experience with that home group. It's been transformational. In that group, I get to carry, you know, experience, strength, and hope. I get to talk about the solutions, the step, the principles, not just the acting out less, you know, not just the accepting, you know, a little bit of freedom. And I get to share that recovery is possible. And in our home group, we talk about, you know, recovery isn't only possible, but it's probable through working the 12 steps of SA. It's not only probable, it's proven. I mean, look, you are like scientifical evidence that recovery is probable. You know, and I get to get sober there, and I get to accept that God has picked me and chosen me and assigned me certain jobs within my fellowship. You will do this. You know, sometimes the jobs are great. You know, I get to choose new locations or decorate the room. Other times, you know, I get to plunge the toilet, and they're both very useful to God. God's used me a lot in that home group. He's given me a lot of chances to do service work, you know, sponsoring. He's used me, in inner group. I get to answer all the hotline outreach calls. 24 hours a day when the phone rings, it goes straight to my phone. And luckily enough, I can wake up really easily. Not luckily last night with Juan Carlos snoring, but normally it's really helpful, you know? And I'm the communications chair. I've been that for a couple of years. We got to do an outreach pilot that ISO paid for some advertising in local, like, you know, those bar magazines where the medical marijuana and the escorts and SAA ads. Yeah. I was the overnight person answering that. So the 3 a.m. calls were really interesting. You know, I got to practice a lot of boundaries and turn down a lot of generous offers, you know. As Garrett mentioned earlier, God's also used me in giving me an opportunity to speak. You know, we've spoken a couple times at conventions. We got to speak last year in Charlotte, and God brought me to Alabama. Get out of here! Can you imagine? I never would have dreamed getting to come here. I had no idea what you were like. Now I do. My recovery has impacted my family greatly. I've been able to make amends with my family. I haven't been able to repair the damage to that relationship. As a result of working the steps, I've been able to establish a new relationship with my parents. A few years back, my parents came to their first SAA meeting with me. I'm not praying it's the last, but we can wait a while until the next one, you know? I was able to make amends to my brother, and he's found recovery since then. I'm not saying as a result, but it's really exciting to have a new relationship with all of them. God has provided me the opportunity to date in recovery. Before that, he provided me an opportunity to be single in recovery. And single, and I really did a lot of step work around this, single is not the status that I am when I'm without a relationship. He provided me the opportunity to become a whole person so that if he should need me to be in a relationship with someone else, I'll be valuable in that relationship. I've had the opportunity to not only date, but to do some sober dating, where I got to go into the relationship with boundaries and expectations and explain to them that, you know, recovery, God, you know, you're a wonderful man, but the best you can hope for is number 3 in my life. Can you work with that? And I've had some great relationships as a result of that. I'm single right now, so I'm kind of curious what the next one is. You know, this might be my relationship. God may need me to be single forever, or may not. I don't know. Let's hope. You know. God's used my recovery in my work life too. This has been kind of exciting. You know, I shared earlier that my disease took my career, took my identity away from me, and so God saw fit that I was always employed in my disease and in early recovery. He also saw fit, and you know, I had a huge fear of being fired. I'm a sex addict, right? So we overperform here, so you won't find out what a schmuck I am. So I always had this huge fear that schmuckiness would encroach into the job. I would get fired. I had a huge fear. And so God removed that fear in recovery. I got fired. So fear gone, you know? And I got fired. God also, in this last year, I was working with a sponsee, Jeff. He was doing his 9-step amends. We were going through his amends. And I had some shame. I didn't finish my master's degree. You know, when I left California and moved to Tucson in my disease, I was alcoholics, sex addict, blackout. So I didn't finish my master's program. And so the sponsee was working on his amends. So I asked him, he worked at the university, to look at my transcripts, you know, find out how many classes it would take to get my master's, what would be left. I owed that to myself. Now, I had harmed myself. I had damaged myself by not finishing school. And so he looked up my transcripts, and I wanted a budget. How much is it going to cost me, right? So dude calls me back like 10 minutes later, laughing like a son of a, you know, he's just laughing at me. What the hell, right? Yeah, apparently I'd had my master's for 12 years, and I didn't know it. I was just in a blackout, and I had no idea that I had my master's degree. Some people have an extra baby or a disease or debt. No, I get a graduate degree. And what I've learned is I didn't have it for those 12 years because I didn't need it and I couldn't use it. You know, God, it's a really precious thing to me. And God had taken this really precious thing from me and put it up high up on a shelf until I grew up enough where I could accept it and acknowledge it and appreciate it. He put it there for safekeeping until I had enough recovery, until he was the center of my life, until recovery came first, until my life had some order to it where I knew how to live life and I could use that to his benefit. And I'm really grateful that he kept it safe for me. As a result of that, I got to change my resume, put my master's on it, because that's really important to me, right? There's a lot of education, maybe some wisdom, I don't know. And I also got to put my sobriety on my resume. My sponsor worked with me a lot on that. What's the most important thing an employer should know about you? My recovery. My program. So I got to put that on my resume, and I got to get a dream job. A job I'm phenomenal at. I'm really good at my job. A job that uses all those skills that I earned and learned in the jobs that I had when I wasn't using my master's. You know? Unfortunately, that resume also went out to a lot of headhunters. So I still get these calls for jobs. And they keep asking, what's the sex addiction thing about? But, yeah, it's okay, And God's also used my recovery in SA, in the program. Many opportunities to work the steps, to live the traditions and love the principles. I've been blessed to sponsor maybe 75 people in the program, mostly men, some women. Currently, I sponsor 13 people. By the end of the weekend, it could be 12. Depends on if they're working the program. And I say 13. Let me be honest. It's not that hard. Back in the day, I sold Tupperware and drag. So I'm used to this multi-level marketing thing, So I've got a structure, I do a lot of sponsorship. I don't see myself as the service provider, as a sponsor. I'm the service coordinator. My job is to know who in the room has experience, strength, and hope on that and hand people out. I'm the service coordinator. I don't have to do it all. I'm not supposed to do it all. It's not, this service, the sponsorship isn't about me, and it's about them. And my job is to help the addict who still suffers find the best support in the room. And sometimes that's me, and many times it's not. And, with all those sponsees, sometimes I sit in a room in a meeting. And our meetings in Mesa, frequently 40, 50 people. And maybe selfishly, maybe not. I'll sit in the room and I count the people that I sponsor. I see how many guys are there, and the guys they sponsor and they sponsor. And not to kind of amass my prizes, but to see the importance of my linkage, Some days I stay sober just because I don't want to let them down. I have a role. God brought me from Tucson to have a bigger recovery. And it's important to me to see the lives I've impacted, When I think of the women, the relationships I inserted myself into, the marriages I affected, and now seeing the marriages I get to be a healing force in by helping the husband get sober. It's a really cool amends to heal other relationships or be healing nature in a relationship because of my experience with the steps. And I get to do those steps a lot. Right now with 13 sponsees, I'm on a couple, 8 steps, a 9th, a 7, a 6, a 1, a 1, a 0, a 0, a 0, a lot of experiences. And it's this first time I went through the steps, I got some, but the umpteenth time, it's a big thing. And as a result of all this, what I've received from the program, we talk a lot about a life I never could have dreamed of. I was happy with the life I had in Tucson. I didn't realize it could get better. I didn't realize that the better keeps getting better, that there's no limit to how good it gets when I trust God, when I seek to serve, when I'm open to what He asked me to do. From this program, I've been given an opportunity, and I don't even know what that opportunity is yet. I've been given God's grace. I've been given a tomorrow, something I never had, something my addiction always promised me. My addiction promised me everything, and it delivered nothing. My recovery has promised me everything, and it keeps giving beyond what I could ask of it. As I mentioned earlier, hitting bottom wasn't when things got bad. Hitting bottom was when I decided that I could do better, that the program could do better. Hitting bottom was when I finally decided to stop digging. My bottom, like I said, didn't happen before I came into the program. It happened in the program. I'm really amazed. I'm shocked. I'm awestruck by the gifts that the program has, how it keeps expanding in my life. And as mentioned for me, today it's not a sobriety issue. It's a recovery issue. I identify as a recovered sex addict. We all identify different ways. A recovered sex addict because I've had a spiritual awakening. I mentioned all those church people I am. All along I was seeking a spiritual solution. I didn't know where to find it. And I found it in the 12 steps of SAA. It hasn't been a sobriety issue. It's been a recovery issue. But for me, sobriety was the foundation of that recovery. It continues to be the foundation of my recovery. Without my sobriety, I don't have my recovery. It started with that. I tried working a program, tried to get the gifts of the program without being sober, and it didn't work for me. I continue to have to build my recovery house on a foundation, a bedrock of sobriety. You know, as a result of working the program today, what am I? I'm sober. That's a pretty cool thing to be sober. I've been sober 7.5 years. I'm learning to be of maximum service to God, my fellow man, and I haven't the slightest idea what the hell that means, you know? I keep showing up, and God keeps showing me some pretty awesome ways to do that. I have a relationship with a higher power who I know to be God. I don't know what you call your higher power. I just know mine is God. I don't know what God is yet. You know, I'm still learning, and I can't imagine what that, you know, learning is going to be like next year. You know, as a result of working the program, as a result of the support you've given me, as a result of the steps, sponsorship, surrender, profound surrender, I have an opportunity today to carry the SA message that freedom from addictive sexual behavior is not only possible, but it's probable through working the 12 steps of SAA. What I have today is the primary purpose, something I never had before. So, if you have these things, please keep doing what you're doing. It must be working. If you don't have these things, please don't act out no matter what. No matter what, please don't act out. Please work the 12 steps of SAA, and please learn the SAA message and share it with others every chance you get. Thanks. I'm done.